O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed
Master,
Dearest
Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you,
I bow to all of you,
free my life from all obstacles,
free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Lovely to be here at last, and we can keep Rebecca in our minds, who's at Anandashram, and also Laura, who has a pinched nerve in her back and is resting, so that she has speedy and complete recovery. The posting from today was clarity of will. Has a picture of Durga Ma. She's a wonderful symbol of will and purity. She rides the tiger, has a sword that cuts delusion and an arrow that makes truth fly straight and to the goal. Master spoke a great deal about will, both the development of it through use of affirmations and maintaining focus throughout a project, as well as uniting individual will with God's will. We do ourselves a great good to pay attention to these lessons. Many of us undermine positive intentions by not acting with clarity, purpose, and bringing them to conclusions. All success depends upon being able to maintain focus on our goals. Self-doubt, obstacles encountered, and competing thoughts and desires rob us of initiative. We are now headed south to Ashland, and it has been one obstacle after another. However, there has been clarity of purpose from the start. It has been God's direction to make this journey. With each problem, He has provided the means for solutions we have needed. At every turn, it has been obvious, and the circumstances could have been far worse. This is his play. He has tested us, our clarity of purpose. Think of will as a muscle group that needs to be exercised. If you start a physical exercise program that is too difficult for where you are now, you will not keep up with it. Dreaming of climbing Mount Everest and not even going out for daily walks will not get you there. You start with getting off the couch and going for walks, then climb hills, go on to master lower mountain peaks, and eventually you prepare yourself for the big climb. Sitting on the couch and dreaming will not get it done. So, start with everyday goals on which to focus your will. Determine that the sun will not set without your achieving a particular goal, no matter what. Make this your daily practice, and you will build will muscle through repeated effort and the lessons you learn. One great lesson is that when you make a determination and keep with it, especially when you invoke divine providence from the beginning, you attract invisible support for accomplishing your positive intention. Feel that you are not alone. God, the Masters, angels, and invisible forces respond to your clarity and uplifting purpose. In this sense, there are no large or small goals, but only one goal, and that is the one in front of you now. Declare with all the power of God in you that you are determined to succeed. Feel the invisible forces in and around you as supports, and when you meet obstacles, as you surely will with any worthwhile goal, Those invisible forces aid and abet you in overcoming. When self-doubt assails you, as may happen to anyone doing something great, check inside for the rightness of your cause. Do not seek to have God on your side, but rather know that you are on God's side through deepened meditation and intuition. Then proceed forward and be his instrument with true purpose in all things. This notion of will is something that has gone on a roller coaster ride in our society. When the humanistic movement started in the late 1800s and the Age of Reason, will was a very important aspect. We talk about Victorian will and having a determination, and then it came out of favor. And then there was a focus on that will was actually the wrong thing, that it was all about feelings. Now, will and feelings go together and should be in harmony one with another, not that they compete with one another. When you determine a will, a goal, something that you are absolutely focused on, this is a good thing. Make sure first that it is a good thing. Is it for your benefit and for the benefit of those people who are around you? Does it provide some kind of good in this world? And when you can answer it in the affirmative, yes, then you know that you are on the right track. You can take that even deeper and go into meditation with the question, is this the right thing for me? This is going from the reasoning mind to the intuitive mind. With the intuitive mind, you combine feeling and thought. It goes beyond reason. You go beyond the likes and dislikes. You go beyond those reasons why you might choose a particular goal. You go straight to the heart of it by intuiting what is divine will here. Intuition is that still, small voice that is deep inside of you. And you can hear it when you get quiet. But if your brain is busy with all the different things that brains are normally busy with, you can't hear it. It's like having a lot of noise coming through on the radio, and you can't even hear yourself think. That's the way that the brain is. It's so preoccupied with the things of this world. Think how oftentimes you enter into true silence, not just outward silence, but inward silence. When I went into silence and seclusion for 1 year, I was given that task. And at first I knew that I had been very busy traveling and giving talks and taking care of all the things that needed to be taken care of before I entered into this year. And as a result of that, when I got into seclusion, the mind was active. And it was just a matter of letting it wind itself down, keeping it focused on the ajna, this point between the eyebrows, chanting as we were chanting before here, using the hung sa, etc. And gradually, it became more and more quiet inside. I remember when I was in high school one time and I walked into the living room and the television was on. My mother was in the kitchen. And I just reached over and I turned off the television. And she said, "Why did you do that?" And I said, "Well, no one's in here watching it." She says, "Well, I just like it for company." And that's the way we are with the noise inside of our brain. We wouldn't know what to do. And many people are deeply afraid of what it would be like to enter into quietude. It is really something when you investigate this and go into the laboratory of your own experience and really go to work on yourself and get into that state of quietness. Many times we try to practice meditation, but the entire practice is made up of a never-ending mental dialogue that is going on and a picture show that is going on in our mind. So many things that can happen in our mind can travel at light speed from one end of the universe to the other, just in an instant. And we have our mind focused on everywhere, except entering into that inner equanimity, that inner silence. So this is a tremendously powerful thing that we can do. Because when we do, we get into that quietness. And as the psalmist said, be still and know that I am God. Being still means being quiet, not just outwardly, but inwardly. Learning to listen and not just jabber along all the time. As we do so, we do get this inner knowingness, this inner feeling, this inner idea. Intuition can come in different ways. Some people see things more in pictures. Other people hear a voice. Other people have a pure thought insertion from the divine. Other people have a feeling, and that feeling grows inside of them. All of these experiences, when they are true intuition, come from beyond ourselves, from beyond ourselves. They are not something that we have manufactured, and we know it somehow. We know it when the moment comes. I'd like to read from Papa Ram Dass. And it's entitled, Religion is a Matter of Experience. The path to the source of your and the world's being is not without. You have to go within yourself. You have to go past your senses, mind, and intellect. You must traverse beyond all your ideas and ideals. You must transcend all limits, conditions, and tastes. And then alone, you will have the fullest vision and realization of your immortal root. The immortal root is also the root of all that exists, the visible and invisible worlds and all beings and creatures in them. Religion is a matter of experience. Merely by becoming a member of a church, creed, or sect, a person cannot be entitled to this experience. By reading any amount of scriptures and sacred books, he cannot obtain this experience. By the observance of rites, ceremonies, or worship, a man cannot come by this experience. Spiritual realization is a question of individual effort and struggle. The man of true religion, when he is on the path, is mainly concerned with his own internal struggle for liberation and peace. A steady and persevering and concentrated effort and struggle alone can lead the aspirant to the realization of God. So long as man is hankering after the pleasures of the senses, his progress on the path is slow and erratic. He must be undaunted in his endeavor and determined in his purpose. He must leave no stone unturned to subdue and eventually eradicate the impure passions of his heart and mind. A purified and enlightened Bodhi alone can entitle the sadhaka to enter the kingdom of eternity. What is required principally is the withdrawal of the mind from without to within, which means that the restless and roaming nature of the mind must be totally curbed by right thought, right contemplation, and right meditation. The mind has to settle down, and its uncontrolled dynamics must be brought under subjection. Perseverance and an unflagging endeavor are the qualities of a true aspirant or seeker of truth. Lassitude, idleness, and heedlessness are the enemies of spiritual progress. Awareness, watchfulness, and effort are the true qualities of a sadhaka. Awareness, watchfulness, and effort are the true qualities of a sadhaka. And of course, as with Baba, everything that he writes is the absolute truth. Because he went the way. He went the path, and it wasn't easy for him. He was prompted to leave home and hearth, his family, and his small girl, and to go off on a great journey, a sadhana. And he wandered without a penny in his pocket, and just one extra cloth. And it didn't make any difference what the weather, how hot or how cold. He took no money, and he took no food with him. And wherever he went, he would beg at the door of this place or that, and if they gave him something, fine, and if they didn't, that was all right. And he went on many milk fasts, and he was chanting all the time, because you can hear this list of things that he did, and you think, what a terrible life, how difficult. But he didn't feel that way, because before he left on this, and he got the prompting to go, he had been chanting this Ram Nam, Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, meaning victory to God, victory to God. And he sang it over and over again, and he got filled with bliss. He got filled with an inward sense of himself, to where he couldn't operate in this world in the same way that he had before. And he felt God so greatly, and he felt himself to being directed to go out. And so he did. And wherever he went, he was taken care of. He describes how one time he is climbing down this cliff. He had no idea where he was or what he was doing. He just wandered as God told him to do. And he got down to this cliff, and he realized that he couldn't go down any further, and he couldn't go up any further. He was stuck, but there is no rescue team. There is no one else around at all. And so there he was. And as he was chanting and putting his whole mind upon God and clinging onto the rocks on this precipice, suddenly he came aware that there was an incredibly tall tree that was just within reach down below him. But he had to let go of where he was. And so he did this. And he was able to grasp onto the tree and climb all the way down. Otherwise, there is no possibility of him going up or down any further. And this is the way God was with him, because he put his full reliance on him. Sometimes we hear people say, well, it's all in God's hands, or I just leave it to God. But this is a very passive way. This is not the way Papa was. Papa was very active. He was chanting God's name. He was feeling him. He was thinking of his attributes. When he chanted this, he would think, oh God, you are all powerful. You are all beautiful. You are all light. You are all love. You are the everything of this universe, and so on. And so he is bringing to mind all the attributes that we think of as God. And as a result of this, his mind became so imbued with it that when he was prompted to go left or to go right, it was God's prompting acting inside of him. It wasn't his own willy-nilly spirit that was taking him, or his mind, or he wasn't trying to determine, now what's the best way to get from here to there? That's not how he operated at all. And God took him to a cave that was up above Rishikesh on the Ganges. And there he was chanting. And this man gave him a pretty rough time who was in the cave. He wouldn't let him come into the cave that he was in. So he sent him off to the next cave, and he wouldn't share anything with him. And that was all right with Papa. Papa accepted everything. This is the way God that was treating him. But he went into the next cave. And as he was chanting, what should come into his vision in a materialized form right in front of him was Jesus Christ and a couple of his disciples. Now, it's very interesting that this Eastern master should have a manifestation of Jesus right there in this cave in India. And he is just mesmerized by Jesus' eyes and how deep and how kind and how loving they were and fathomless. Went beyond anything that you could describe in a human sense. And so through these teachings, we learn that there is a universal truth, that wherever you go in this world, there have been religious teachers that have come down from time immemorial, and that these teachings have come down and then become codified into religions. And many times the religions don't even resemble the original teachings that were given. But those who are kindred spirits, those who have sincere desire in the depths of their souls, they are drawn to the truth, either in the scriptures or they are drawn to a true teacher, one that can help lift them from the human to the divine. And when they get this, and when they feel this, and when they have this experience, their lives are totally transformed, even as Papa's was, even as Master's, even as Mother's, even as Jesus was at one point. We oftentimes think of these avatars or these great spiritual beings, such as Babaji, that they must have always been this way. And one time when I was feeling perhaps a little sorry for myself, and I was thinking how small we are, how pitiful are our efforts compared to the great ones, and how they must look down upon us. And interestingly, God immediately responded to this thought, and he said, it's not that way at all. These great spiritual masters, at one time or another, maybe perhaps in a previous lifetime, have been going through exactly what you're going through. They know what it is to not have pure determination. They know what it is to feel weakness. They know what it is to fall short of the goal. They also know what it's like to pick themselves up and to keep going. They see all of that inside of you, and they know something more than that. They know that which they eventually became, totally and fully God-realized beings. And so they see that in you as well. So you see, they see you better and more clearly than you see yourself. And this was eye-opening, because we always think that we're just alone in this world. And oftentimes we think we're just a nothing, and it doesn't matter. But it couldn't be further from the truth. You think about each one of these great spiritual teachers and beings, and how they at one time must have felt that same way exactly. But they didn't stop there. They kept going. And as a result of that, the world was changed. Now, sometimes a teacher comes into this world and just has a handful, a few here and there. Others take on a greater role, and they affect thousands or millions or perhaps even billions of people. But it's all with the same purpose, and it's all to provide the same quality, that individual or those individuals who follow should be lifted up. Jesus said a remarkable thing. He said, "And if I be lifted up, shall lift up all humanity with me." Now that is the truth, and yet we see this world around us, that not all beings are lifted up, even as Jesus was lifted up. But it's like a chain, you see. You pick up one link of a chain, and you start to lift it up higher and higher. And then other links also get lifted up. Now, there are still some that are on the ground, but each are getting lifted up. And the higher that link is lifted up, the more other links are lifted up along with it. And eventually, the whole thing can be lifted up into the sky. And this is the way that it is. This world is an evolutionary course. Now, in the beginning, evolution occurs through biology, because we come into these physical bodies. And so we are driven by the needs of this body, whether it be hunger or thirst, whether it be a need for recognition, whatever it is, that is driving force within this evolutionary course. We want to learn something, and so we go to school. We want to become something greater, and so we get a job, perhaps, or we seek out some adventure of some kind, because we want to make a mark. We want to do something that matters, that makes a change in this world. And when you do that, you are working out your evolution. But at some point, evolution only takes you so far, and then you come to a standstill, and you get the feeling that there's nothing new in this world, as King Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, that the world just seems to be the same. There's nothing new in it. And you get that feeling, and it grows over you, and you can get despondent at that time. And sometimes great souls even have wanted to kill themselves because they feel so discouraged about this world. But then something awakens inside of them. They see that they're can be something more, but it's not going to be found in this world. We have to transcend it. We have to go beyond it. And when we do that, we start in the course of involution. Not evolution, but involution. We go inside. We become inward, because that's where the truth is. Not through the reasoning mind. It goes beyond that. And not through education that we get from others. It goes beyond that as well. It's an awakening that happens. Plato described it as if you're sitting in a cave and there's a fire behind you and you see dancing shadows up on the wall of the cave. And you think that's the entire world. You think that's everything, all reality. He says that's what it's like to live in this body. We're all watching these dancing shadows on the wall of the cave. And then one day, some intrepid, brave soul gets up from where he's sitting, and he ventures out, and he finds the mouth of the cave, and he comes out, and he sees that there is a bright, beautiful, technicolor world, something that had never been imagined, perhaps had been whispered about, sometimes it's been talked about, but who could really know what it was like until you moved out of the cave into the big world outside? And when you have done that, you have awakened to yourself, And it's like that. It seems as if you had been sleeping beforehand. And it is like that with all people who are just simply tending to the body, just simply feeding themselves, going to work, doing the things of this world. It's fine on a certain level. But on a spiritual level, it doesn't get you where you're going. You can attend the biggest mega church around. You can have all of the music. You can have all of the raising of hands and all the rest of it. And it doesn't get you God realization. Because for that, you have to take the involutionary course. You have to really work at it. Really set a goal for yourself. When you meditate, meditate every morning and every evening. But take some time out in the week. If you have a day off and you can spend more time, then go deeper. Determine in yourself to go 1 hour, 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, whatever length of time. Because there is something that happens. It doesn't happen automatically, because if you just are daydreaming and letting your mind go here and there, you're not going to get the results. But when you're chanting, when you're deeply meditating, then you get that upliftment, you get that bliss. Sometimes going into deeper meditation, it felt to me like going into the greater depths of an ocean. You would start out on the surface, and then you would drop down to a certain level. And within the ocean, there are these different thermal layers. And these different thermal layers are worlds unto themselves. And in your meditation life, as you drop down, you can come to what seems to be one of the floors of these thermal layers. It can feel as hard as concrete, and it starts to resist you. You get thoughts, you get distractions, you get everything except for what you're trying to keep your mind on. And it'll come at you, and perhaps you'll get desire nature, perhaps you'll get fear. Anything at all can come, and this is what gets people off meditation. Whether they realize it or not, they may have a meditation that's like this, and then suddenly they just start staying away from it because they don't want to experience that fear, or they don't want to experience that desire nature, or they feel how powerful and how life-changing this is, and they're not really sure that they want their lives changed. It would leave them out of control in that sense. And so these resistive forces come up, and we can actually just let meditation drop away and never come back to it. There's a story of a man who was searching out for heaven and for God. And he went through all the three worlds, finding both the physical and the astral and the causal. And finally, through his long, long search, he came to the door of God. Now, I don't know if it had a plaque named God on it or what, but somehow he knew God was on the other side of this door. And so he's started to climb up the steps, and there are 7 steps that he is climbing up. And as he went step after step, he finally got to a point, and he thought, well, what'll happen when I go through this door? All of my life I've searched for this, I've wanted it with everything in me, but I don't know what's going to happen. What if God should obliterate me? What if he should find fault with me? What if, what if, what if? They all went through his mind. And so he made a determination. And he very quietly, so he didn't disturb the great being who was on the other side of the door, took all the steps down and went away as far as he could. And he knew he could wander anywhere in this universe except to that point. He made that decision. And sometimes we make that decision. Sometimes there's an eruption of Kundalini deep inside of us. And it frightens us. It scares us. And so we decide to stay away from that. You see, there's just so many oppositional forces. So we have to have courage. We have to have determination. We have to have perseverance. We have to be willing to give up everything in this world, and that includes our own life. Now, it's true, when you give up this life, that you really discover who and what you are. You really discover life for the first time. But you have to enter into it willing to give up everything. And this is not an easy thing to do. I remember one time that God took away every thought that I had. I was in the nothingness of God. There is no thought there at all. Now, many of us have great pride in our thinking. We can get a long ways in this world with a good mind. And then you think, well, where would I be without a mind? We've seen people who've had diseases and other kinds of things that have wiped out their mind, and seemingly there's nothing left. Nothing left. So, what happens if we should surrender this mind and give it up too? It's quite a thing. And you get to that point. And if you have that determination, as I did, then you even give up your mind. You give up your thought. You give up everything that you are. And then you think, what will people think of me? They'll just think I'm an idiot. They'll think that I've lost my mind. And what of it? What of it? If God is in control and is He taking you on this great adventure, then we must be willing to surrender all of that. And when we do, we go beyond body. We go beyond feelings. We go beyond thought. We go into the pure spirit of divinity. You know, the mind cannot contain everything that is God. God is infinity, and the mind simply can't embrace infinity. We can say the word. We can have a mental concept of it, but that's far different than the reality. And so this little bubble of the I, this little bubble of who I call myself, my name, my profession, my home, my business, my money, my family, whatever it is that is the object of the my, has to go. Has to be surrendered. Do you see how that works? Because if it is not, then you are too small. Then you maintain this littleness that cannot embrace the infinite. You can say all of the words. You can have the intellectual concepts, but that does not get you the realization. You have to go through this trial of fire, and it is a trial. Somebody said, can't you come up with a better analogy than a battle? And I said, think about it. Think about the great religions. That one is a battle of Kurukshetra. Another is a crucifixion up on the cross. The Native Americans used to go out on this search, a vision search. And they left everything behind. They took no food, no water. And they stayed there until they got the vision, or they died in the process. You see, it's all the same. It's always going toward the same goal. And so you give up everything that you are. Now, people don't like to hear this. They just want to hear how they can get rich, how they can get famous, how they can marry the right person, have good children, whatever it is. That's what they want, and that's all right. That's all right. They're God's children too, and they're exploring God in all of these different avenues. But it will not get them the true and lasting happiness that they've been yearning for. And so you enter into the laboratory of your own soul. You go deeper and deeper depths. You go beyond those thermal layers in the ocean, because the pearl that of great price that you are looking for is only down at the bottom of the ocean. And for that, you have to go through everything that keeps you from going deeper. The pearl of great price comes from this story. There was a man one time, and he had this most valuable pearl in the entire world. And this is a very, very long time ago, but he put a very high price on it. And he said, this pearl I will only sell for $1,000. That's a great deal of money. And nobody would take it at that. And so people came, and they would try to bargain for it. And they said, well, I'll give you $500 for it. The man said, no, I'm sorry, it's only for $1,000. And people bid at various prices and up and up and up. And finally one man said, I'll give you $999.99. He wanted a little bargain, just even a penny off, make him feel better about it. And the man said, nothing doing. It's $1,000 or nothing. And this is the way it is with God. It is all of us. There's no part of us that we can keep aside, that we can keep from going deeper, because that will act like bubble that will just take us right back up to the surface. It's a very interesting thing when you're meditating deeply. And suddenly you drop into these one of these deeper states, and suddenly a thought will come to you. And you'll pop right back up to the surface just as quick as you can think. And it's because we've attached ourselves to something. Something triggered a desire nature or fear. You know, desire nature and fear are really just two sides of the same coin. And we have to give both of them up. Both of them up. Now, we still live in the world. So we go about, and both mother and both papa, they enjoyed eating, they enjoyed life. And so we have to realize what this means, that if there's anything that comes between you and God, it has to go. It has to go. And our battlegrounds are different based on our own natures. One person's battleground will be a nothing for another person. Why do you have trouble with that, they think or say. That's no problem. But for that other individual, they'll have another area that will be problematic for them. And so we can't really judge somebody. Some people wear all of their problems out on the outside. Other people look all right, but they have a lot of problems on the inside. But you might never guess it. And so we have to understand, unless somebody has fully realized God, everyone has something that they are carrying. They're carrying their own cross, which is their body, which is keeping them from full divine expression. Because that is your natural state. Did you ever think about that? We have all come from God. We are sustained in God as the preserver. And we are withdrawn back into God as the destroyer. Now, Mother tells a wonderful story about the word Om. And she said, in the beginning, God was. And then he thought to himself, I'd like to express myself. I'd like to create here. And so he breathed out a word, and the word was A, Ah. And out sprung all creation out of that one vibratory nature of God and thought. And it all went out, and he looked at it, and he saw that it was good. And so he wanted to preserve it. And so he said the word, Ooh. And he preserved all of creation. And then one day he thought, well, I want to withdraw it back into me. And he said, And he drew all creation back inside of him. Those are the three letters of Om, which is the Indian way of saying Amen. And so God breathes out, creates, he preserves, and then he withdraws it all back into himself. And in truth, it is always a part of God. It is not like he creates something that's outside of himself. Everything that is has come from him. Well, we look at the evil in this world. We look at the darkness. We look at all these things. And we say, how can that be part of a good creator? Somebody who is loving. But we look at a play or a movie that we go to. And there always has to be creative tension in order for it to mean anything. Otherwise, we would quickly get bored with it. There always has to be an antagonist, someone who is opposing. And the hero requires an antagonist. Otherwise, they can't be a hero, can they? And so the antagonist comes, and it brings out the better nature of the hero. It brings out his strength. It brings out his courage. It brings out his creativity. It demands that of him. And so when we enter onto the spiritual path, we will surely find opposition. Those who are not in favor of us doing what we're doing. They'll try to draw us back in. When Siddhartha Gautama was born into this world, he was born a prince. He is the only son of the king, and his father fully expected him to take over the kingdom. And there was a prophecy when he was born. He said, if he lives a life that he doesn't encounter any suffering in this life, up until his 21st year, I think it was, he said, then he will be a king, and he will be one of the world's greatest kings they've ever known. However, If he encounters any form of suffering at all, he will renounce this world and go seeking the truth. Well, the father is a king, and naturally so, he wanted his son following in his footsteps. So he did everything that he could so that the son would never see suffering. He kept him in a huge garden, but it was very controlled. There are no old, there are no sick, there are no diseased people in this garden. Only young and beautiful people. And that's how he grew up. But one day his charioteer took him out, and because God had other designs for the Buddha. And so he took him out, and suddenly next to the road there, he saw someone who was ill, had sores on him, he wasn't able to walk correctly. And he asked the charioteer, "What is this?" "This is sickness, sire." "Why does this man have it? We can all get it." "Even kings?" "Yes, even kings." Well, this got him started thinking. Then they went further down. And then they saw another man who was very, very decrepit. His skin was all wrinkled. His teeth were gone. He was in a weakened state. And again, he had the charioteer stop. He plied him with questions, found out that everybody was subject to getting older. Oh. This disturbed him very much. And then they went further, and they saw a man who was dead, lying on the side of the road. This, too, brought forth the questions. And he found out that all people are subject to death. Well, he thought to himself, what is the purpose of life? If everything ends up this way, why go on? Why do anything? And it disturbed him. He couldn't get it out of his mind. And he kept going over it and over it and over it. And he realized that he must find the solution, if there was a solution to be had. If there was to be a solution to be had. And he would find it not only for himself, but he would find it for the whole world. This is his generous nature, his generous heart. He didn't want just the truth for himself. He realized that suffering was something that everyone is subject to. And so his huge heart of compassion went out for the struggle. And for 7 years, he practiced all the austerities, doing everything that he could. But he finally came to that point where he had to surrender everything. Surrender everything. He realized that of himself, he couldn't do it. It required something else. And he nurtured his body back to health because he had gotten into such a weakened state from all the austerities that he had. And the people that he had been doing his sadhana with, they all thought he'd fallen off the wagon because they're very austere. They wouldn't eat hardly anything at all during the day. They wouldn't satisfy the body at all, but Siddhartha went out and he started eating. He made his body strong again. But then he said, "I have to know the truth. I have to know the truth." And he sat underneath the Bodhi tree. And he sat there until that wonderful, wonderful moment when he got that full realization. But you see, he had to surrender even self-effort. And even then, still the temptations came all through the night. But he passed every one of them. And then he was lifted up, and he saw all of his previous incarnations, and this is the truth. When you get into this state, all of your lives can become open books to you. But you see that they are all part of your past. There's nothing greatly mysterious about previous lifetimes, you see. It's just like a previous time in your life, a previous year in your life. You wouldn't say there's anything deeply mysterious. It can be meaningful, because it's helped form who you are today. But there's nothing that needs to be mysterious about it. It's just simply a life that you lived. And all the lessons that you learned from that, the patterns that you develop, they remain with you. And so he saw all of his past lifetimes, but he saw more than that. He was lifted up and he saw all eternity. What it's called in India, nirvana. Nirvana, state of complete realization. And then he came back from that high, high, high state. And he started coming back into this body. And again, that compassion was awakened in him. And he thought, I want all the world to know what I know, because this bliss, this inner experience is so tremendous, beyond anything I could have imagined. And then he thought to himself, how can I teach anyone about this? It is so much more than what most people are focused on. And so it seemed an impossible task, but he had a brilliant, brilliant mind, and gradually a plan began to form, in which he developed the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, so that others might follow along behind him and experience what he experienced. You see, true teachers, they don't want to be worshipped in themselves. They want you to have the same experience that they're having. They want you to become not who they are, but become as they are, as one in God. Now, when the Buddha was asked about God, he says, he deferred it. He said, why talk about, that's all speculation. You don't have the means to understand it. So it's fruitless to talk about it. Get the experience. And then you'll know the truth of what I'm talking about here. Become a Buddha yourself. You see, Buddha is like Christ. It's a designation. It's a title. Buddha means the awakened one, the enlightened one. Christ means the anointed one, the enlightened one. It's the same kind of designation. And so he wanted that for all humanity, even as Christ wanted that for all humanity. To all them who received him, gave he power to become sons of God. So you see, it's the same teachings that are embedded. It's a different culture, it's a different language. So there's different symbology, there's different ways of talking about it. But when you get right down to it, they're wanting the same experience for you and for me and for all mankind. But in order to do that, we have to follow in their footsteps. We have to be willing to give ourselves and everything that we are at the feet of the divine. And if we are willing to do that, then we too might become a Buddha or a Christ or a Krishna. That may seem beyond conception for many. And this may be part of the problem. They haven't really began to think that that Christ nature, that Buddha nature, is in you as well. But it just can't be lip service. It just can't be a belief or a thought. It has to go beyond that into the reality of your own experience. So this is our calling. And if we hear it and we respond to it, we lead a life of purity, we lead a life of love, we lead a life of service, then we too might be lifted up into that divine kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, and dwell there forever and forevermore. Will you please pray with me, O Heavenly Father?
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence.
Of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
In every part of my being,
my heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Om.
bliss.
Amen.
Pranams, bow to the light within you.